It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
KFI AM 640, you have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. Oh, I love my Sundays. I love to come in. Franz, did you notice that I'm in my iHeartRadio t-shirt today and my sweats?
You look very comfortable. Yes, you do.
Thank you. They're my Roots sweatpants that I just picked up at a sale in Ottawa when I was there at a wedding. It's because I'm moving, and I'm moving tonight. I literally... I'm packing up my car. My best friend's meeting me with her SUV, and we are beginning the process tonight. It will go on for the next few days. But, you know, I have to be in what I call fighting attire, which is super, super comfortable. All right. So just because I'm moving doesn't mean I have stopped living. And for those who are asking, I am only moving down the beach a ways. So don't worry. I'm not going too far, not going far away. Just want to be in a better school, all schools are great, we hope, but some schools are more appropriate for some kids. And so I had one kid who went through a particular school and did great there, and the other kid was sinking in this school because she's not a good match for it. That's it. No good, bad, just not a good match. So that's why I'm moving. But I want to tell you what I did last night. Brooke, have you been on the rum tour at the Lost Spirits Distillery?
I have been trying to get on that tour for a year. In fact, last Christmas, I went to get tickets for my boyfriend for Christmas, and it was closed.
They had a fire.
Yeah.
Because that's what happens when you have 61% proof.
Right.
Franz, have you heard about this thing?
Yes, I have heard about it, but no, I have not made my way down there yet.
Tessa, have you been to the Lost Spirits tour?
I want to go.
Okay. Everybody better go online right now, because you don't need to have a velvet cord or get on a red carpet. You just need to get a reservation. It's very affordable, but you do have to wait. I think I bought my tickets back in April because my daughter was coming home from college for only 1 week. And I thought, well, that's a fun thing to do. She'll be 21. It'll be great. And couldn't get tickets until mid-July. So I booked a bunch anyway. And then I get like a reminder. You know how you do? You forget. And I get a reminder email from the place on the morning of, and I'm like, oh, no. And I'm frantically emailing friends and pulling people together for it. So let me explain what it is and why I loved it so much. Not that I'm a lush. Well, I have been known to be at times, but not in general. It's that it's geeky and it's artsy. It's in the Arts District downtown. It was started by five, I believe, Stanford chemistry major guys who decided that they would build a rum that molecularly would be identical to a rum that could be 20, 30, 40 years old. In fact, there's one they're doing right now that is an exact replica of a rum that was made in 1850.
Yeah, I thought it was like the whole idea is that they were almost like the pirate ship, like the old pirate rum recipe.
So once they figured out how to use high tech to make 20-year-old rum in 6 days... then they said, well, to present it to the public, we're not going to sell it in liquor stores. We're not going to sell it to restaurants. We are going to make a tour that is out of this world and use their artistic abilities. So I don't want to give it all away, but it is kind of like, it's down in the Arts District, the east side of downtown. It's kind of like Willy Wonka meets Pirates of the Caribbean. It is insane and so much fun. I want to give one thing away because I think it was a kind of highlight. So at a certain point, you know, you've gone through a jungle maze, you've ridden a boat, you've sat in a whiskey room, you're taking shots and they're telling you about this. And I'm sipping and throwing them away into the plants because they're telling me 61 proof. Do you know what proof means? Do you know what that means, Franz, or where that came from?
Actually, I do, but
okay.
I'll let you explain
about the sailors, right? So when the sailors, the Royal Navy... we're bringing sailors over. Everybody had a daily ration of rum, right? And as the tides were bad, the winds were bad, they didn't want to have mutiny from the sailors, the captain would sometimes sneak downstairs and water it down to stretch it out because time was going on, and if you ran out of rum, there would be mutiny. And so the sailors started to get wise to the fact that their rum was being watered down. So they'd say, show me proof that it hasn't been watered down. And here's the rule. They, in order to ensure that their rum had not been watered down, they would have to prove the spirit strength by pouring it on gunpowder and then trying to ignite it. If it lit up, they knew that the alcohol content was greater than 57%. If not, it was considered underproof and meant that it had been watered down. Isn't that interesting? So this was 61 proof. Ah, it, honestly, the first sip, they tell you not to take a sip too fast, but to sniff it first and then breathe it in with your mouth. It tasted like a campfire that had been put out 2 days ago. It was smoky and ashy and nothing like what we're accustomed to today. But we tasted other rums like Jamaican style that was a little sweeter, and we tasted hints of pineapple, etc. But I wanted to tell you the best part. So after we go through the Pirates of the Caribbean kind of boat ride and the whiskey room, and they have an authentic old library and everything's dark and whatever, they send you out. They tell you, the last thing they tell you is, so our liquor license says we're only, it's so strong, this liquor, we're only allowed to serve you an ounce and a half at this location, but we can move you to a different location. And we're like, what? And we go through this narrow passageway. It's all dark. I'm up a few steps. And then I realize I'm on a bus. I'm on a bus that has blacked out windows, and the inside has made to be a replica of a 1940s German submarine, complete with portholes. And while we're heading who knows where for 20 minutes down a freeway, the portholes fill up with water and fish. Like you, okay. So the friend that I was with, he couldn't resist. So he had to look at his Google Maps while he was on the bus. And he goes, I think we're going like to Bellflower. I don't know. Anyway, so it's called a mobile tasting room. And then you get to their lab where the really interesting part is. So I don't want to give away the whole thing, but I just want to tell you the thing that most fascinated me by the time you end up in the lab is that you find out that they've been trying to replicate, and they have replicated this rum from 1850. Because somebody had a bottle of it in New Orleans, and one of their buddies went and convinced him to give them a shot. They come back. Remember, they're Stanford chemists. They look at them and like, blah, 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 and they see it was made in Medford, Massachusetts, because that's where the Navy had to make them for the sailors heading back, in 1850. So they go and collect yeast from the forest there so they could get the exact chemical composition. But wait, they also needed to have a replica of the barrels that they were cured in, and it was made out of American chestnut wood that is now extinct because a blight had come in the early 1900s. Somebody brought some European chestnut or something with bad bugs in it, and they all died. So then these totally nerdy scientist chemistry students go on a antique roadshow and try to find old antique American furniture made out of this chestnut, American chestnut, and they do. And they discovered a way, using very bright lights that hurt your eyes. You wait. I don't want to give away the whole tour. It's crazy. Brighter than sunlight. They shine on this petri dish of rum, and they're able to melt a chip of wood that normally would take 20 years, and they can do it in 6 days. It's amazing. Okay, so it is called the Lost Spirits Distillery. They have not paid me to say any of this. I just want you to know it's a fun adult thing to do. Here's the rules. You have to go with a rideshare, a Lyft or an Uber, whatever. You have to go on a full stomach, and you have to go without any alcohol in your system. They're explicit about that. You sign a contract. So you got to show up. I went out to a huge Italian dinner beforehand. I was very full. I had lots of water with dinner. I didn't even have a headache afterwards. It was fine. So if you follow all those rules, that's important. All right, when we come back, let us talk about some research that says there are actually some benefits to social drinking. Did I do something good for my health last night? I'll tell you. You're listening to KFI AM 640. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
KFI AM 640. You have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, and I'm a wee tad obsessed with the science of human mating. and with the science of love. And there is a science to it. Biological science, psychological science, sociological science. A little later in the show, I'm actually going to be talking more about the biopsychosocial pieces of love because I'm just so damn interested in it. Last night when I was on the rum tour, the Lost Spirits tour, there were two other couples unrelated to us. And one person in my party said to the girl, oh, like, are you together? Are you together? You know, and one girl said, oh, we're here on a double date. And can you believe the dude she was with said, well, I wouldn't call it a double date. I was like, oh, man, what do they do? They talk first before they think? Dude, just smile and nod. Sip your rum, okay? Let her think whatever, but is that the time, the public time, to shame her, to let her know you're not into her? Is that the time? Just saying, take a little lesson. Smile and nod and don't call her back. That's fine. Ay, ay, ay. All right. You ever been traveling to the UK and you walk into a little pub in Ireland or out in the countryside outside of London and you feel like you've walked into somebody's tiny little living room that everyone seems to know each other and they all kind of look at you like, who's the stranger who just walked into our local pub? Well, I was reading this research out of University of Oxford, of course. The Brits do good research. And it shows that moderate alcohol consumption actually may be linked to improved well-being. But it's not about the chemicals in the alcohol, which we know are not good for us. I'll get to that in a moment. But it's about the improved social interaction and specifically associated with having a drink with friends at a local pub versus going to a nightclub with a whole bunch of people and doing a bunch of shots, right? So what they did is they did three separate studies. One was just a questionnaire of pub clientele. Others where they observed conversational behavior in pubs. And they also looked at frequency of alcohol consumption, type of venue people were in, and what kind of social experiences and happiness they were experiencing. And what they found is...
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
That having a drink at a local is important in your community group. And if you do it regularly, it makes you more socially engaged, more contented, more likely to trust members of your community. They also notice that people who go to a local pub regularly have smaller social networks, and they're more trusting of and involved with their local community. So let's think of an American piece of that. When I compare that, I think to myself, well, those are the Brits. They got a little bit of social inhibition, and so they may need something to open them up a little bit. Here in America, we're mostly a country of extroverts and a me generation, I. So do we have to do it by having the alcohol? Do we have to go to a local pub? Could it be at a Starbucks? I don't know that Starbucks is the right idea because it's so corporate, right? But it could be a local coffee shop. I mean, wasn't the whole series of Friends based in a coffee shop, right? So maybe there is a way, and maybe the point of this research isn't about social drinking as much as it's about getting involved in your community, getting outside the doors in your community, getting to know your neighbors. You know, I've lived in my neighborhood for 22 years now. And whenever new people move into the buildings around, because some are renters, some are buyers, whatever, people move, change. I try to hold barbecues and dinner parties, and I invite everybody on every side of me. And I have a very selfish reason for doing this. Even if I only break bread with them once in my life, and we all have to exchange phone numbers in order to do that, then I know if something bad happens, I've got someone to call. And I fed them. They owe me. They have to save my life in the earthquake, just saying that. No, but it's good. I feel better. I sleep better at night. I've been a single mom raising kids alone. It's nice to know who's sleeping in a bedroom 12 feet from my bedroom, that if I wanted to ever yell out the window, I could. Okay, so that's the benefits of social drinking, but it's not necessarily about the alcohol unless you have great inhibitions and it helps you relax a little bit. Here's the bad news. This research study came out this week, and you may have heard about it on other news sources. I want to break it down a little bit. We know that there's kind of a little crisis. It's not the opioid crisis. It's the mommy wine crisis. Is that way too many women suffering from the stress of having to juggle parenthood and working are knocking down some wine. And I have friends who weigh 110 who are downing a bottle of wine every night, who consider themselves not alcoholics because, of course, they never have a hangover. They're up. They're driving their kids to school. But I know the research. Let's just start with the breast cancer risk. Alcohol consumption increases the release of estrogens and other kinds of hormones associated with what we call hormone receptor positive breast cancers. I'm sorry, I'm sighing because I got to say this next sentence. Only 3 drinks per week raises your breast cancer risk by 15%.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I know.
No.
I know. It's terrible, isn't it? A few years ago, I went on a moderate drinking management program, and it's called Alternatives. It's in Beverly Hills. They didn't pay me to say that. But I happened to meet the scientist, the doctor who's in charge of it, in the CNN green room one year. And I said, what are you on? What are you talking about? And he goes, oh, moderate drinking management. And I thought, oh, I thought it's AA or nothing. And he's like, no. Plenty of people don't have the criteria to be psychologically an alcoholic, meaning they're not trying to medicate their emotions and their feelings, but they've become physiologically addicted. And I'm like, oh, that's me. I like to have a glass of wine every night. So when we come back, I'm going to tell you what I did at the moderate drinking management program and why we all could stand to quit drinking a little bit. And also why your credit score matters in love. You are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. KFI AM 640. This is Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. So while I was talking about that there may be some social benefits of moderate drinking, the problem is that for many people, alcohol becomes addictive pretty quickly. Even if it's not psychologically addictive for some, it can be physiologically addictive because the alcohol cycle takes about 24 hours for it to fully leave your system. And don't you notice, like, you start to have that hankering for the beer or the glass of wine about 24 hours after the last one, right? You're kind of on a cue. So I did a moderate drinking management program. In a quick bullet point, I'll tell you this. Their motto is relax and then have a drink. In other words, learn lots of other ways to have relaxation, mindful meditation, yoga, etc., and then decide if you really need that drink to relax. Secondly, take days off in between to give your liver a rest and your brain a rest. And one of the reasons for doing this is corroborated by this new study that came out this week that says that women who drink alcohol and then quit have improved mental health. So here's how it went down. The researchers looked at the drinking habits and mental health of 10,000 people in Hong Kong and 31,000 people in the U.S. No heavy drinkers were allowed in the study. So that's still a pretty big study group, right? We're talking 41,000 people. And what they found is that in both groups of both men and women, if you had been a lifetime abstainer, you tended to report the most happiness and the most mental well-being. The others were followed over time for 2 years, and they found that quitting alcohol was linked with a more favorable change in mental well-being among women than men. Huh. Now, all kinds of reasons why this could be. Abstinence could reverse alcohol-related brain injury, or quitting alcohol reduces life stresses. Maybe alcohol is causing the problems. That's why you're screaming at your kids. I've been there. I know what it is. Maybe it reduces family conflict. Also, here's the thing about alcohol that's really tricky. Alcohol, when you first drink it, relieves anxiety, but it also stimulates, activates systems in the brain that make anxiety worse later. So it leads to that cycle of I need more alcohol to relieve my anxiety because my anxiety is worse. I know. Maybe it's because women in general experience more depression. They don't know why. But anyway, ladies, we could all stand to do more mindful meditation and less imbibing. Hey, I struggle like the rest of you. Trust me. I thought about it last night. I'm like, oh my God, I think I drank the last four nights. I need to dry out. I can't. It's too much. I need to take a break. All right, moving right along. Can we talk about your credit score? I have to tell you, I'm a landlady, so every once in a while, I have to do checks, whatever you do, on tenants. And a while back, I remember some tenants came from the UK, and they had, like, no paper trail of, you know, like, how do you get your DWP hooked up when you have to leave a big deposit and all that. And they didn't have pay stubs. They hadn't started their job. And, like, what do you? And I was just like, yeah, but do you have a credit rating? And they're like, yeah. And I remember my realtor being like, this was years ago. He's like, oh, you know, you need to get like bank statements. You need to get pay stubs. You can't just go. And I go, credit rating is everything. All my training as a psychologist tells me that all I need to know about somebody is what their credit rating is to know if they're going to keep my place nice and if they're going to pay the rent on time and if they're not going to be noisy for the noisy neighbors. I know that from a credit rating. And you're saying, now, how can you possibly know that? First of all, let me explain what a credit rating is. It has nothing to do with income. In other words, you can be low income and have a high credit rating. You can be high income and have a very low credit rating. I have lots of those low friends in high places. Trust me. Credit scores are directly linked to certain psychological traits. Think about it. Your ability to carry debt responsibly. Have good planning ability to know when to pay it off and how to pay it off. You can, it shows that you have good impulse control. You don't suddenly run out and buy that hugely expensive thing that you can't afford and then run your credit up, right? That's poor impulse control. So believe it or not, credit scores have been, people with high credit scores, has been linked to trustworthiness, risk aversion, conscientiousness, and dependability. So if I know that about a person, then I know enough to decide if they're going to be a good risk for me as a tenant. Now, there's this new research that came out of London's Global University and Harvard Business School. And the study is called Good Credit and the Good Life. Credit scores predict subjective well-being. That's psychobabble for happiness, right? So we all know that money can't buy happiness. However, these researchers looked at the credit scores across two big samples of people in the United Kingdom and the United States. And what they found is credit scores predicted life satisfaction even after they controlled for other stuff like financial, you know, income, spending, debt, home ownership. You could say, well, people with a high credit rating probably own their own home and that makes them happier. Or people with a high credit rating probably have more money in the bank account. Not necessarily. You can actually factor out those other things and go, let's just compare only credit rating. And so I start to think about this because I'm moving. So, of course, I had to run my own credit recently. And I'm not going to tell you my credit rating yet. Maybe I should let you guess. You know what? On Instagram, I posted on Instagram just now at Dr. Wendy Walsh.
No, I think we should do a round robin.
I agree.
Okay, so we should do a round robin too. So we know that credit rating, wait, what's the range? It's
like 5 to 850 or something? 5 yeah, to 870?
Yeah, I think it actually can go as low as like 400 and something, oh. But you don't want to know that person. 850 is the top, right? Is where it can get.
So, yes!
All right, so round robin. France, we'll start with you. What do you think my credit rating is? Think of trustworthiness. Think of risk management, conscientiousness.
I'll say 750.
Nice guess, 750.
I'm Brooke? Going 820.
820?
Yeah.
Whoa.
I think you're up there, girl.
Okay. Okay. Tessa?
I'll go 758.
Okay, I'm not going to ask any of you what your credit rating is.
I don't know mine.
But Brooke, you were the closest. I was 8:16.
The
is that insane?
Wow,
that's excellent. That is excellent.
Okay, but I'll tell you what.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Why? Because I deliberately manipulated it, and I'll tell you how to do it. If you need to raise your credit, you need to learn to carry credit, and it costs me money to do this. So I'm one of those people that I'm cheap, so therefore, I'm not actually cheap. I'm pretty generous with others, but with myself, I just don't like to throw money in the trash, so I don't like to pay interest. So every single month, I pay off my credit cards 100%, and I could never get my credit above 800. I'm like, how is this possible? I always pay off, and I have so much credit, and I just never use it, so I should be the person. No, 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 no. Those companies want to see you use credit responsibly. So here's some rules, folks. I learned this from asking people. Don't have more than 3 credit cards. If you have 8 credit cards and 3 of them are with department stores, that's a problem. Close those off. And it's going to take a few months to adjust. Close those off. Only 3 credit cards, never more than 3. And then carry a little balance, like $1,000 for a few months, and pay that awful interest that you have to pay, the finance charge, for a few months, and stagger them a little bit. So it looks like, oh, she decided to go shopping at Macy's because she just needed that fabulous outfit, but she's not using the Macy's card then for a couple months. And then on another one, it's reporting, say, a month later, oh, she decided to buy this, but she's paying it off in chunks. And you just pay it off in chunks. Some people say if you're a young person and just starting your credit, you save up some money, you put it into account, and you borrow some, and then you just pay it off with money you already have. So you don't even have to worry about making the money. But that's what you do. And I watched it shoot way up because I carried credit and I responsibly paid it back. It killed me to pay those interest charge, but it's nice to have the high credit rating. All right. So what does all this mean? Well, there's new research to show that your credit rating is linked to success in love. In love, this is what we care about. Okay, so a team of researchers, are you going to wrap me up, France, or can I get going on this? How much time do I have left?
Oh, whenever you'd like to finish.
Whenever I'd like to finish? Okay.
He got so wrapped up.
That's what happened. Well, here's the thing. When I talk, everyone should know this, I lose all concept of time. I'm just focusing on what I'm saying. So I'm probably the only person in America who does talk radio who cannot look at a clock and follow the time. I'm sorry. I just can't. So I put it on poor France to look at the timer and tell me in my ear how the time's going. And sometimes, just sometimes, I say something interesting and then he's like, uh-oh, I forgot to wrap you up. Hurry up. Like already they're telling me to do it. So when we come back, I'm going to tell you about this new study that will tell you if you have a certain FICO score, what that FICO score is, and whether you will be moving in with somebody in the next year. Yeah, the data's out there. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640.
Oh, help me, please, doctor. I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart.
KFI AM 640. If I was late coming in with that cue, it's because I'm eating something called a Power Crunch Kids Protein Snack with 10 grams of protein and only 5 grams of sugar. So that's good for me for the next few hours. all right, your credit score and why it matters. Thank you for those on Instagram who are telling me your high credit scores is very sexy, I just want to say. Well, that's what the research says. So they did this study. They looked at consumer credit reporting that represents 12 million Americans, and they looked at it from the years 1999 to 2014. So over a 5-year period, they unobtrusively, looked at the FICO scores of 12 million Americans, and then they looked at their street addresses to figure out who was moving in with who and who was divorcing and separating. Now, they also developed an algorithm, of course, to kick out the people who were, you know, just roommates or adult children moving back home or that kind of stuff. They had a way. You know, computers know everything. The data is there, folks. So the previous study I'd mentioned to you shows that the higher your credit rating, the happier you are. My theory is that is because America is not about how much money you have. It's how much money you can get. And in a pinch, when some bad thing happens, isn't it nice to know that you can reach out to somebody and get some money if you needed to? So it is a feeling of security. So here's what the new study shows, though. If you are single, but your credit score is high, you are more likely to form a committed romantic relationship in the next year.
Yes.
Oh, amazing. In fact, analysis reveal that individuals whose credit scores are 109 points higher than average. You know what the average FICO score is, everybody? Want to guess at that one?
Ooh, round robin.
Ooh.
Average. If it goes from 450 to 850, where do we think it is?
450 to 850. Average. I'm going to say 620.
France. You can put the music on.
Actually, I'm going to say the average is 700.
No, I bet it's low. I bet it's like 500.
All right. Dang.
Well, according to the Google, it's 695, which is actually pretty high.
That is pretty good.
Okay. So then the research looked at, if you have a credit score that's 109 points higher than average, which would be me, you're 14% more likely to form a relationship than lower credit counterparts. Remember, this is not about income. It's not about wealth. It's about these personality traits that indicate how you live your life. Next question, who pairs with whom? Well, it turns out people aren't even aware of this. It's out of their consciousness, but there is some self-sorting based on, you guessed it, their credit scores. The more similar your credit score to somebody, the more you are likely to hook up in some manner. Well, hopefully for the longer term. Get this, though. Even if couples have similar credit scores, you know that their scores aren't going to be exactly alike, right? The further their credit scores are apart from each other, the worse their relationship outcomes. If you have a 66-point difference or larger in your credit score with your partner, you have a 24% greater likelihood that you will break up this year. Oh, my goodness.
So, Dr. Wendy, we should be asking people what their credit score is rather than their sign?
There actually was a dating site about that, Date Your Credit Score.
Okay.
Which I think is the most... Nobody asks on a first date what somebody's credit score is. I do, by the way. I find a funny funny way to throw it in.
I'm going to do it, too. Forget this. Yeah. I'm going to do it.
Because it says so much about their personality. Okay, so here's what else the research shows. I love this one. Over time... Within couple differences in credit scores tend to narrow. So if you are far apart, if you spend time together, you have an influence on each other. So makes sense. You're probably making shared financial decisions. You're calming the person with the poor impulse control and saying, no, we can't afford this right now, right? Here's the funny part, though. If a partner has the highest credit score at the start of a relationship, they're not always the one who has the highest later on. As they get into it. So maybe those absolute prudes who are so afraid to take risks have somebody like Brooke who pulls them out of their shell and says, come on, let's go wild. Let's take a vacation.
It's actually the opposite.
Oh, it's the opposite?
Nervous. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that about you because you are the most perfect person for attention to detail. I love Brooke. You are like the best mind to be in my aura because I'm missing all the things that you have. But that's not all. Improving your credit score predicts relationship stability over time. People whose credit scores increase by 93 points from their initial meeting through the second year of their relationship are much less likely to split up. So there you go. Who needs all this love and relationship advice? Just work on your finances and your marriage will stay together. This particular article was written by Teresa E. DiDonato on Psychology Today. And there's lots more there if you want to read it because it was fascinating to me. All right. So we know about credit score and success in love. Can money actually buy happiness? What does the research say about the price of happiness? We certainly know that if you're living the kind of life where you're worried where your next meal is coming from, you're worried about getting evicted because you can't pay your rent. You're worried because you can't put shoes on your children's feet. We know that for you, money can buy happiness. it can buy some peace. But there's a certain point where money stops buying happiness, where having more things, and here we are, this crazy consumer generation. You know, tomorrow's the Amazon Prime Day, and I had the audacity to go on the app to see, because they tell you the day before certain things that are going up for cheap for tomorrow. And I was like, I don't even need anything. I'm purging right now. I'm moving. Why am I doing this? So I did not buy a thing. When we come back, I'm going to tell you the magic number of, if you make this amount of money, you're as happy as you can get. Any more money is not going to make you any more happy. You're listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. KFI AM 640. You have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. And my headset's gone out. Now it's back. Okay. I think the arm of my chair hit the button and it knocked me out. You know, the buttons. We're talking about money and happiness. And should we, since we're in the mood for round robins today, what amount do you think that if you make it every year increases your happiness up to a point? And then after that, you get diminishing returns. In other words, you get a raise, doesn't make you so happy. You get another raise, even less more happiness. So what do you think that magic number is for income?
I will say I do know the number, but I am curious if this is individually or total as a couple even.
Individually.
So if you have a couple, it could be double it?
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. I know the number, so I have to abstain.
Okay. You have to abstain. Franz, what's your guess? How much a year, annual income?
I'm going to say $150,000.
$150,000? What do you guess, Tessa?
I'm going to say $100,000, but that's overall, not in SoCal. I think it's probably a lot higher in SoCal, but $100,000.
So, yeah, you two are speaking like people who live in a bubble in Southern California where everything is expensive here.
So maybe like, yeah.
National average, you ready? $75,000.
$75,000.
It's attainable.
That's great.
So here's what, if you, again, are living below the poverty line, or if you're living in the lowest socioeconomic status where the stress and anxiety that you feel every day about your survival, the survival of your children is dependent on every little bit you can make. But once you get up to making $75,000 a year, so say you get a raise and you make $80,000 or $90,000. The research shows, this is research out of Princeton University economist Angus Deaton, shows that starts to level off the amount of happiness. And in fact, as you get higher up, there's actually a happiness big decrease because social climbing anxiety kicks in. In other words, if you're poor and all your friends are poor, you don't feel poor because if we use money and our wealth as our identity, we have to compare it with somebody or somebody to know where we're standing, right? And so what happens, and there's other research that's been done on social anxiety, and the people who have the least amount of happiness tend to be the upper middle class. So if you compare them to the lower class, the middle class, and the wealthy, the upper middle class have the most anxiety around money. Why? You want to guess, Brooke?
Well, because they're looking up and they want to be where the people above them are.
Exactly. They're They're the silver medal holdless. They're looking at the gold medalist going, why aren't I there? And the bronze medalist is happy to just have a medal, right? Happy to be on the podium. The same thing. So what happens is it's the family in Southern California who, I mean, I can't believe I'm going to say this number. And if you're listening anywhere else in the country, please just understand we live in a weird and wacky place here. And your house is only worth $1 million, right? That's a bungalow, right? On West LA, right? Only worth $1 million. And you are driving maybe one luxury car, a Mercedes, right? Only one. And the other one is a Prius for your wife. But yet you're invited to, fancy movie screenings and big charity events where the tickets might be $250. You get to hobnob with the people that, where you aspire to be, then you're just always reminded that you don't have enough. If you go to a party in mansions that are $10 million. However, if you make $75,000 a year and you live in the suburbs and your house costs $300,000 a year and you share that mortgage with your wife and all your friends in the neighborhood make about the same amount, you are happy and I want to go to your barbecue. Okay? That's the happy people. This week, I was actually camping up at Lake Kachuma, and a lot of people who like to camp they probably leave their luxury cars home is what they do. But anyway, they come in pickup trucks and older model cars, and they pull out tents and even like some major equipment I didn't even know about. Did you know you can set up a vertical tent that has a shower in it? I heard the kids showering. I'm like, oh my gosh, for the money they spend on that, they could be at a hotel. But anyway, I got up early walking to the bathroom in the morning, and I would see the families, like multiple families all together in their tents, and they were firing up bacon and eggs and laughing, and they had music going. And I was like, that's love. That's happiness right there. They don't need to be at a five-star resort, although some of their equipment, it was pretty expensive, I could tell. But they, and some of those pickup trucks were pretty serious pickup trucks, I will say that. So it's not a statement necessarily on their income. The statement is about family and being together. And that is the stuff that brings happiness. So is it possible to win the lottery and feel happy? The research shows that people who win lotteries or suddenly get a huge inheritance, no happiness goes up. Okay. They're happier overall as a group. But when compared to, say, accident victims, believe it or not, some of the accident victims derive slighter joy and pleasure from little things every day. It's the small things that make us happy. And one famous study in 2008 from the University of California, Santa Barbara, found that unexpected income shock. Oh, I want that problem. Unexpected income shock found with lottery winners. Well, these people were not measurably happier 8 months later than before their windfall. Okay, happiest places on earth. We all hear about Denmark being happy. But guess what? The World Database of Happiness that measures the levels of happiness in its people found that if everybody has a certain set of standards the same, that countries that you might think are not affluent actually show more happiness. Costa Rica, Puerto Rico, Mexico. Why? Again, it's about family. It's about the people. All right. If you are going to spend your hard-earned money, what are the things you can buy that actually create happiness? Well, obviously, less stuff. The more stuff we have, the more claustrophobic we feel, the more we are compelled to want to buy more. And I don't know why. I've been purging lately. I love to purge. Purging and organizing makes me so happy. I'm a minimalist. Okay. Here are the things that you can spend money on that does increase your happiness. Buy time. That means buy services. Send your laundry out to a service. Have someone clean your house. Have someone clean your car. Unless you really love scrubbing down that gorgeous pickup truck that I saw at the campground. Okay, great. If that brings you happy, do it. But if it's something that feels like a chore to you, order food baskets in if you don't like cooking. Send your laundry out. You can get Fluff and Fold for, I think it's a dollar something a pound. And they weigh it dry afterwards, not wet. So it really can be affordable if it gives you a few hours to spend with your kids. The other thing associated with happiness is spending money on others. If you've been listening to me for a while, you know that my New Year's resolution was to, rather than support charities, to support the working poor. Because I take great pride in being a heavy tipper. And I love to walk out of a restaurant and have my kids look back and go, oh, he's looking at the check. He's seeing it. He's seeing the $40 tip. Oh, my God. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's so fun. Like little surprise windfalls on people. So people who are driving Lyft and Uber, I click the best tip and I try to as much as often as I can because I love to give money to people and I don't necessarily want them to know who I am or whatever. It's fun to do it anonymously, too. It's my little thing. It makes me happy. And also, hate to say it, but saving money. Save your money a little bit and have some sitting in an account. Yes, it leads to greater happiness. All right, when we come back, where are we going? Can we finally start to talk about your love relationship and the tension that you're experiencing, because everybody does, between adventure and security? Apparently, domestic life and erotic life have trouble living together in the same house. But I've got some advice for you. You are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. No.
KFI AM 640. You have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is what I love about doing live radio. I have listeners who know more than me on certain subjects, and they quickly tell me, thank you very much for writing to me, Randolph Favor, who is a professional credit manager for the last 25 years, according to him. And he told me that you can have up to 8 to 10 credit cards with as much limits. He's got 175,000 in credit limits. And what he does, which is so smart, is he puts all his bills on them, phone bill, electric bill, gas, mortgage, everything on credit cards. And he rotates them from one to the other so that he still pays off the full balance every month, but he never charges more than 10% of his total limit. And that's the way, he says, to raise your credit. He claims his credit is between 830 and 850. Ooh, that's very sexy. Just want to say. All right, so if you want to know, there you go. If that's the truth, we're going to go with it. All right, back to our love lies, shall we? A woman who I've been following a lot online because I love her work, you may have read her book called Mating in Captivity, is the psychotherapist Esther Perel. We are trying to get her on my podcast, Mating Matters, and hopefully we will do that soon. But if you haven't seen any of her TED Talks, you might want to check them out, because she has found a way to sort of coin what is going on in many marriages, which is this struggle between domesticity and eroticism, and how to kind of put them all together. In fact, she says, the basis for marriage is the problem. The basis for marriage has changed over the years.
Marriage was an economic institution in which you were given a partnership for life in terms of children and social status and succession and companionship. But now we want our partner to still give us all these things. But in addition, I want you to be my best friend and my trusted confidant and my passionate lover to boot, and we live twice as long.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So we come to one person, and we basically are asking them to give us what once an entire village used to provide. Give me belonging, give me identity, give me continuity, but give me transcendence and mystery and awe all in one. Give me comfort, give me edge. Give me novelty, give me familiarity. Give me predictability, give me surprise. And we think it's a given, and toys and lingerie are going to save us with that.
Yes, toys and lingerie are going to save us in our relationships. When actually, our sexuality happens in our head. You know, I think we need to erase the idea that someone or something turns us on, or someone or something turns us off. It's us who hold the controls. We have the ability to turn ourselves on or turn ourselves off. Now, the challenge, of course, and Esther Perel says this so well, don't you love her little Belgian accent, is that to have love is about a feeling of security and closeness. And to have eroticism is to have a feeling of longing and adventure. And how do you have those two things living under one roof in one relationship? And she's got some great suggestions for people. First is to just be aware and acknowledge that, you know, it's not supposed to be hot and heavy sex, especially because we know the very thing that makes babies kill sexuality, sex life, right? It's not supposed to be hot and heavy all the time. So partly it's changing your expectations. But secondly, just being aware that you have to not only manage these two paradoxical things, one, the eroticism in a relationship, and the other, the feelings of security and domestic life, right? So, but she has some suggestions. And one is that we respect the sexual privacy of our partner. In other words, your partner has their own sexuality in their head, and that they are allowed to have private time for their sexuality. Now, I'm not talking about stepping out of a relationship and having other partners. I'm talking about you don't need to probe them for what their fantasies are. You don't need to say, why are you in the closet watching pornography? In fact, it's a crazy idea to think that the two of you should be in sync at all times, both in frequency of sex, the kind of sex you want, the fact that both of you should orgasm or it's not sex. Forget all that. Throw it out the window. Your partner has their show going on in their head. You've got your show going on in your head. And that's what you need to focus on. Don't ask yourself why your partner isn't turning you on. Ask yourself why you've shut yourself down. Or ask yourself, what is it that you need to do to make yourself feel more sexual? Take responsibility. And Esther Perel has done research in 20 countries with her book, Mating in Captivity, and she's interviewed people everywhere. And she asked them, what draws them closer to their partner? And interesting enough, they will often say, when my partner's away. So if you spend literally too much time together, I mean, probably the most challenging relationships are the people who live together and work together. They run businesses together. That's really hard because you need a break. When you first met your partner, you looked at them from afar at first. And so the other thing she says, what draws you to your partner is they say, when you're looking at your partner and they don't know you're seeing them, when they are in their moment, when she is holding court in a business meeting, when he is the king of the castle at a party, talking to people and telling them a great story, when you're watching them as a stranger in their performance personality, that is a turn on. Well, you've got to set up the situations where that can happen because you're always going to have to balance this idea of maintaining eroticism, I'll get the word out, while you're being domestic. All right, when we come back, 10 things you can do today to improve your relationship. You are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. KFI AM 640, you are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. I send newsletters out once in a blue moon, usually when we have a new podcast episode up, Mating Matters. I definitely don't spam you. But if you want to get on my newsletter list, you just text the word Dr. Wendy, D-R, Wendy, to 42828. So the number, it's like you're dialing the number 42828, and in the text box you write Dr. Wendy, and you'll be automatically put on the newsletter list. You can also follow me on social media everywhere. The handle is at Dr. Wendy Walsh, at Dr. Wendy Walsh. Okay, so Esther Perel, one of my favorites, who we hope to get on our Mating Matters podcast, talks a lot about how it is so hard for long-term married couples to manage keeping things erotic while also having the feelings of closeness and security that love and domestic life bring. So I have a few little bits and bits of advice that might help you think about ways that you can, you know, be aware of making your relationship maybe a little more spicy. And I mean mentally spicy because it all takes place in your head. Try asking your partner something new about anything. Like put a little effort into questioning your significant other. I know you say, how was work? And I know you say, are you picking up the kids? What time can you be there? You know, we have to be so-and-so place. Your life becomes about scheduling. But when is the last time you asked your partner, what's on your bucket list, love? What can we get done that'll make you happy? Or, I know you say your job's going well, but do you ever see yourself doing anything different? Think of a first date question. Imagine you just met your partner and you're asking a first date question. They will be seen in a new light by you, and they will feel seen by you. Now, I know you've heard this next one before, and it sounds silly, but it's really important if you're in a long-term married relationship, which is designate a monthly date night. Now, if it becomes a chore, like, oh, we have to hire the sitter, and oh, it's a Friday night, and you got tickets to what? And it's at Dorothy Chandler. We got to drive downtown. If this is what it becomes, then it's defeating the purpose. But how about each month you take turns in planning it? And it is a surprise to the other. Remember, an erotic life is about adventure, right? Maybe you take them on the Lost Spirits rum tour one night. But take turns scheduling it. Make sure that you've set up childcare or whatever needs to happen to make it happen. Esther Perel says this, foreplay should not begin 10 minutes before you'd like to make love. Foreplay should begin 5 minutes after you've just had an orgasm. That means in your head, start the planning. Start thinking sexy. If you are waiting for sex to spontaneously happen in your long-term committed relationship, I will tell you, it's already happened. Spontaneous sex happened. It happened in the first year of your relationship. That sex ain't coming back. All right? Now it's got to be conscious, planned sex. Remember I said that couples report that their partner is most attractive to them when they're in their own space of self-confidence, when they're holding court in some way, when they're doing something they're really good at. Well, one of the ways you can help your partner get to that psychological space is by expressing your appreciation for them, letting them know that you think they're great. Pay attention to the words coming out of your lips. If most of the words resemble some form of "what have you done for me lately?" Oh, well, that's a way to turn somebody off. There's no greater way to kill a sex drive than anger, right? Or feeling criticized. Who's turned on by somebody who criticizes them? So catch your partner being good. Catch your partner being beautiful and sexy. And let them know. Here's a good one that's really important. You know, we get on schedules because we like... See, human beings are wired for two things. Security and novelty. We want safety and we want newness. So one of the ways to create newness is to move out of your safety zone. And that may be tweaking your schedule, changing up your lives a little bit. If you're always going to bed at the same time, if you're always getting up at the same time, if you're always taking the same routes, your relationship is going to feel as boring as your life is feeling, right? I remember one time I was dating somebody and we went to see a comic at one of the comic places. I don't remember. Was it the Comedy Store, the Laugh Factory, somewhere on Sunset? And the person we were there to see kept being moved later and later and later and later. And I'm actually naturally a morning person. I love to go to bed early. And we ended up staying there till 1 a.m. to see this act, which was very late for us. And we were really tired the next day. But it was fun. It was something different. We woke up having lost some sleep. That was kind of cool, right? So that's what I mean. If you're used to seeing a movie at 7 o'clock every night, go to a 9:30 showing. It just changes up everything. It creates some novelty. If you're used to going to the gym every morning, go at night sometime. It shifts you, and that shifts your relationship. Now, I mentioned complimenting your partner, catching them being good. But that means remember the small things that your partner says. The devil is in the details. That also means the big stuff is in the little stuff. Pay attention to what they're saying or what they're not saying. When you're talking about your future, listen closely. Pay attention. Because we go on autopilot. Look, I even do it with my kids. And I swear, they'll be like, "I just told you. Don't remember. I told you. I said it 3 times. I'm like, I just wasn't listening. It's almost like I'm listening for changes in intonation instead of changes in words. So it really is the little things when you pay attention to your partner. I would say you should spend with everybody in your household who you love and have an intimate relationship with 20 minutes a day where you're not looking at a phone, you're not cooking, you're not folding laundry, the television is not on, and you're looking at their face and talking and reconnecting in intimacy. 20 minutes a day. Now, if you have 3 kids, yes, add it up. That takes 2 hours with your spouse. No, an hour and a half, sorry. Hour and 20 minutes. But, you're going to have to spend that time if you want to keep intimacy alive. Here's probably the hardest thing to do that every couple needs to do. You need to start out every day fresh and new and let go of the past. The thing that kills relationships are old problems, old fights. And couples stay in the same fights for years and years and years. If you've had the same argument and have the same stumbling block every time, I'm here to tell you it's not going to change. It's not going to fix. The only thing that can change is your reaction to it. The only thing can change is your decided ability to forget the past and start fresh. Move forward. Never drag old stuff from the past. And finally, this is so, two more things I want to get in that are really, really important. Learn how to say I'm sorry. It is the way to heal any relationship. And I know that there are many family systems where you may have been brought up with the blame game. Well, it's her fault. It's his fault. It's nobody's fault ever at any time. And in your relationship, if you have conflict, you want the winner to be the relationship. You don't want the winner to be him or her or her or her or him or him, whatever. You don't want the relationship to be a person. You want the winner. Sorry, you don't want the winner to be a person. You want the winner to be the relationship. And that means biting your tongue, sucking it up, and saying, I'm sorry. Plenty of times. Why do you think us Canadians learn it, eh? We say, I'm sorry. I say, I'm sorry if I bump into a lamp. That's just how we do. It's our cultural way of being nice to each other. And finally, and this is so important, show affection. When your partner comes in at the end of the day, no matter where you are in the house, no matter what you're preoccupied with, get on your darn feet and go give them a hug. Greet them. Yes, you may have greasy hands because you were underneath a car. Yes, you may have wet hands because your hands were in the dishwater. I don't care. Turn and welcome your partner home. It doesn't matter who got home first or second. And before you go to bed at night, give each other a hug and kiss every single night. Even if you're sleeping in separate rooms because somebody's snoring, go find them. Huggle, huggle. That's like cuddle and hug at the same time. Huggle, canoodle for a few minutes. You get such a release of dopamine. It's so good for your health. It's good for your mental health. Please do it. Show them, you know, I always use that saying, water your garden, not the weeds. And that's how your garden grows. If you spend time focusing on the negative, that's what will grow. All right. When we come back, I know you've been reading in the news about financier Jeffrey Epstein, who's been demoted. He's not a billionaire anymore. That was wrongly stated. And his raping of underage girls. Yeah, you can't give consent. You can call it sexual scandal if you want, but I'm sorry. If they're teenagers or tweens, according to a quote from him, that's rape. And so I want to talk through a lens of evolutionary psychology of how Jeffrey Epstein's evolved. You're listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640.
Oh, help me, please, doctor. I'm damaged. There's a pain. Where there once was a heart.
KFI AM 640. We are into the home stretch on the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. And if you know me, you know that I am an evolutionary psychologist and I'm always asking the question of why. Why do people do that? Why did that happen? Why did that evolve in us? And this week, I had a lot of whys about a certain man named Jeffrey Epstein. He is known as a financier. The media erroneously, early in the week, called him a billionaire because people love to throw around that B word. But in fact, they can't prove that he's never been on the Forbes list of billionaires. In 2008, he was convicted of soliciting a 14-year-old girl for prostitution in Florida. He served 13 months in, quote, custody with work release. It was part of a plea deal where federal officials had identified 36 victims, 36 victims at that point. This is 2008. So he spends 13 months getting out of prison all day long to go to work. He goes home to sleep, whatever. So apparently it's not over yet. Thanks to some journalists at the Miami Herald, they've been digging up new things. And also, we are now in the post-Me Too era, where people are not squelching the stories of women and young girls. There is a quote that's been quoted in a number of places, including the New York Times, where after the 2008 incident, Jeffrey Epstein said, "I'm not a pedophile. I just like to date tweens and teens." Do you know what a tween is? That's a demographic identified by the advertising industry, and it is girls aged 9 to 12. Okay, not a pedophile. All right, all right. All right, let's look at it from evolutionary terms, and let's take all our moralizing out of the picture for a minute and try to explain what's going on here, how it's possible that in our evolution, a man like this could have evolved. Well, first of all, men generally have high ambition and try to earn more money and become rich and famous so that they can have access to more mates or higher status mates. Also, men are wired to desire youth in women because men are basically wired to compete against other men for mates, whether it's competing by making more money or whether it's competing by just gaining access to women. They desire youth for a couple reasons, the main one being that they're guaranteed that another man's sperm has not reached the egg. In fact, sadly to say, Jeffrey Epstein referred to some of his victims to their face as, "You're so pure." Apparently some of them had braces, and he said, "You look so pure." All right, so in an unconscious way, it was like he was saying no other man's sperm is there. Did you know there's a whole other war that goes on inside the vagina that guys can actually shoot fighting sperm that come out first that cannot impregnate anybody? Their sole job is to just go kill another dude's sperm that might be out there. So there are other men who also want what Jeffrey Epstein wants, and they have worked in law. They're not as rich as Epstein, so they make laws to keep young mates off the mating marketplace. Do you think women have been running around trying to protect kids? Of course we have been, but do you think women had the power historically to make laws to protect youth? And so they create laws around sex with minors because these men need to buy the time they can to make more money, to have access to the mates. The longer they can keep these young mates off the mating market, the better. And then alpha males share female mates with other males to increase their social status. There is some rumors, unreported, alleged, that he was sharing these girls with Prince Andrew or his lawyer, Alan Dershowitz. Both deny those claims. Already, Trump's labor secretary, Alan Acosta, has stepped down over the fact that he was involved in the shady 2008 plea deal that got him off so lightly. And I don't believe that Jeffrey Epstein will be the first head to roll over this. And there was some argument I was reading somewhere that, oh, these girls, you know, they were just drug addicts or whatever. No, one girl was a cheerleader and had straight A's until after she was abused by him and then turned to drugs. That's evidence to me. And really, anyone under the age of 18 cannot give sexual consent, especially if the man is in his 40s, 50s, or 60s. So this will be an interesting story for us to watch because it is part of our changing social climate and the battle of the genders. I'll keep you apprised. As always, you can hear more on human mating and the evolution of human mating on my podcast called Mating Matters. You just go to your podcast app, you type in Mating Matters, and you find it. We put new episodes up all the time, and they're evergreen. They're always there. Thank you so much for being with me. I am here at KFI AM 640 every Sunday from 4 to 6. You have been listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.